This is John Shanklin, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 29th of November 2013. John Shanklin, Part 2.
Did you dash out and buy a copy of Nature?
No. I can't even remember whether I was given one. I was definitely given a preprint of the paper, so that's the bit with just our paper in it. And I don't think I got a copy of Nature itself until the 25th of anniversary when they did a reprint.
Right, okay. Was there any peer group review corrections or adjustments? Did you have to compromise your article after it had been sent out for peer review?
There certainly were referees' comments on the paper, which mostly Brian and Joe dealt with. I don't recall particularly anything. From what I recall, they were mostly minor in nature. Very quickly accepted that the main thesis of the paper was fine.
Very difficult to actually find somebody to review it, wouldn't it, because it's brand new material?
There would have been experts both in atmospheric chemistry and in general ozone measurement, which would be the two areas. So there was quite a large community, even in the UK, that were involved in ozone research in one form or another. And again, obviously in the US, there would have been the satellite groups. And so I don't know who the referees were, but I'm sure it would be relatively straightforward for Nature, with all their contacts, to find a couple of suitable people who would have the background to be able to say this science is okay or it isn't.
So let's look at the reaction then to this, perhaps starting off with a press reaction. Were there journalists on your doorstep the next day?
I certainly don't recollect any coming in. And I think it took a little while before the realisation dawned that this really was something quite fundamental.
On you or them?
On the media, yeah. Particularly, that, yes, Nature highlighted it as sort of one of the discoveries, but I think even Nature, it took them a long time to realise that it was one of their top 20 papers of the 20th century. I think that was something that was shocked me even more than getting the paper in the first place. A friend of mine who works in publishing came up to me and said, did you know your paper was in the top 20 of the 20th century that Nature's just published? I said, no. you mean to tell me we rank alongside Einstein and all the other major discoveries? And yes. And I think that was even more shocking than the sort of general recognition that this was an interesting discovery, that it really is seen through the whole scientific community as being a fundamental game changer.
Was there anybody in the scientific community who was calling you a crank?
They called us a sort of the backroom boys who were isolated from the real community. But I don't think they called us cranks. It was quite often portrayed as sort of David and Goliath, with Goliath being the massive NASA research effort, and us as David with our little slingshot, because we weren't that highly funded and we just kept tinkering away and did things. But I think we were always regarded as reputable scientists, that there was no hint that this was idiosyncratic or anything else science. As soon as the evidence was published, that's all right. There were alternative explanations put forward for what it might be due to, but they could be very quickly discounted.
So when did the press begin to wake up?
Well, I think it was more as it became evident that this was going to really push the discussions on a treaty to limit the CFCs. And so the forcing behind, first of all, the Vienna Convention and then the Montreal Protocol. And once that envelope became more to the political forefront, then this paper was clearly very significant in that debate.
All right, so it was a kind of the political activity which happened before the press activity.
I think that was, I mean, it was a scientific activity that led to the political activity. So there was a broad scientific push which linked into the politics, and then once you got politics, the press became much more interested than just the straightforward science.
So let's look at the political repercussions then. How and when did you first start to notice those?
Again, this was something that Brian and Joe were much more involved in, particularly Joe, who did a lot of the politicking and pushing for more and more demands on limiting the CFC emissions and working with the Montreal process. I was just there supplying the data and kept feeding in the data, and by and large doing minor talks to the public rather than the major talks that influenced the political process.
How was that for you?
Anyways, I was quite happy with that. I'd always envisaged myself as one of the backroom boys, not at the forefront. And I remember as a child going to the dentist and talking about orthodontists and getting teeth straightened out and things like that. And when it was talked about having a brace to straighten your teeth out so you have a good public image, I said, well, I'm going to be a backroom scientist, so I don't need any of that. And to a large extent, I've stayed as a backroom scientist, that I provide the information and then somebody else forefronts doing the public speaking, although I suspect I have quite a good reputation for public speaking.
Yeah.
But I don't regard that as sort of the primary role, certainly at that early stage in my career.
Lack of confidence?
Almost certainly, yes. And that may be another reason why I didn't go into teaching, that I didn't have the full confidence to discipline a crowd of unruly pupils. I was quite good at teaching the science and getting the science done, but not so good at keeping the discipline. Whereas I think I now have learnt how to discipline the kids, so that if I do go into a class or even into a group of adults, I know the technique to quiet them down, and they do.
And what about the chemical industry? When did they start listening to John Shenklin's evidence?
They'd always been surprisingly supportive, I think. And immediately after we published, they provided funding for an ozone sonde programme to actually investigate what was going on in greater detail. And there were no strings attached to that. It was, here's the money, go and do the research, tell us the answers, which is quite illuminating in many ways. There's often a feel that industry controls the science and only allows the publications that they want. Well, in this particular case, it was quite straightforward. We want to know what's going on. Go and find out what's going on. Tell us what the answer is, and then we'll worry about the industrial ramifications of that. And I think they were always of the view that perhaps there were things that they could definitely do, so there were alternative products that they could develop. And perhaps it was even in their interest that we were right. That was certainly how it was seen
later. Interests.
Yes, because the patents for the manufacture of CFC were coming to an expiry date, so that they would become open source, as it were. And so if you could come up with something else that was patented, then you could make much more money. So there probably were those sort of views. But it was quite nice that they funded the science and you went and did the science. And whether that is still the same for a lot of industry today, I don't know. My impression with the greenhouse gases debate is the sceptics are largely funded by pressure units,
NGOs,
that don't want the changes that will be required by the science. So they try and rubbish the science.
Oh, I beg your pardon, right.
So it's not the NGOs. The NGOs are probably too vociferous the other way, saying things that the science doesn't actually say. And it is a very grey area. There are issues where it's not at all clear-cut. So when I give talks, I say, well, there's all these different things that drive the climate, but the balance of probabilities now that we're changing the climate, it's not absolutely impossible, but that it might not be us, but the evidence is so overwhelming that my view is that it's us.
I'll come back to that later in May, whilst we're on this other track. So do you think Joe's public work, publicity work, was kind of forcing the hand of the chemical industry? I know that's a very big generalisation, but they wanted to be seen to be good boys.
I don't know. Clearly, they always like to be seen in a favourable light. But I don't think they particularly made much of the publicity of saying, look, we funded the British Antarctic Survey to do these measurements. So that was sort of done out of the limelight, as far as I'm aware.
Did you find yourself in the limelight much?
No.
Again, by choice?
I think more by chance than choice, that everybody wanted to speak to Joe because he was the first name on the paper. And so nobody particularly asked the third author's opinion.
I have to ask you whether that rankled at all, despite your shy, retiring nature.
I think although I've always said it's a team thing, it did always seem that Joe took rather more of the credit for the discovery than was perhaps deserved. But these days, well, that's how it is, and so I stress that it was a team thing, even though it was me that led to it, if you like.
And you were the junior man.
And I was a junior member of the trio, yeah.
Let's look then at the changes that took place as a result of that paper, both in the world at large and in John Shanklin. Let's start with you. Did it change you at all?
Probably not, or if it did, it was a very slow change that in some sense it would have come along anyway as I slowly progressed over the years with Bass. But you can't really tell what would have been the case if you hadn't done Action A. The future's totally opaque and you can never rewrite history. So I don't know how much it influenced me and how much it didn't.
I was thinking in a very personal way that, let's use newspaper headlines, the guy who changed the world. You did make a sufficient contribution to the some knowledge of our planet for other people to do something about rectifying damage.
We did, but somebody else would have found it if we hadn't. So in that sense...
But it was
we
you.
Didn't, but it was us. So it is nice to be in that position where you actually have made an impact. And I think what's nicest is that virtually everybody's heard about the ozone hole. So it's something that is a worldwide thing. There's no argument about it. And if you say, I was one of the scientists that discovered the ozone hole, ooh, right, this is somebody really important. So at the...
Are you important?
Well, obviously, everybody else thinks I am because I went to a botanical meeting in London last Saturday and I was introduced to a few people as this is the person that discovered the ozone hole. And the people that I was introduced to subsequently said, oh, that was one of the most impressive things about the whole meeting. We met the person who discovered the ozone hole.
But the other argument is you just happen to be a junior scientist who happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right information.
And I think that's an important bit about science. A lot of it is chance. You need the right people in the right place at the right time with the right background. And any one of those strands, the discovery isn't made or somebody else makes it. What you have to be as a scientist is be ready to see the oddities in your data. And that's probably why we made the discovery. I had sufficiently wide a background that I could see that there was a clear pattern in the data that needed to be followed up. And whether it was the scientific education at school and at Cambridge, or whether it was my general interests in the environment and nature, or even bell ringing, and this jumper I'm wearing has an embroidered pattern on it, which are bell ringing methods.
And I have been wondering.
And it looks like a bell ringer, you have to memorise patterns and be able to pick out patterns. And perhaps that's one of my abilities, is the ability to recognise patterns. And you can see patterns in data just as you can see patterns in bell ringing. So I would say that that was perhaps another influence that led to the discovery. And it's just a combination of happenstances.
So if those same statistics have been in the hands of a man with a different mindset, perhaps somebody doesn't go bell ringing, it may have been missed.
It might well have been missed, yes. Yeah. And that's science for you. But when you're being taught, I think it's very important that you teach people to keep an open mind, and also to try and have a broad range of interests, because I don't think in future that real advances will be seen on the narrow focus of science that generally we have today. You need a few more polymaths that will have a wide range of interests, that they can link factors together across a range of science, and that's where the real advances are most likely to come. And that's one worry I have with today's increasing commercialisation focus of science, that the politicians want to direct where the science goes, and that is a recipe for failure, because in the past the UK's strength has been this blue skies approach, just go out and discover something, doesn't matter what, and you can actually afford to invest in failures if the successes are so spectacular that they cover you. And that philosophy really doesn't translate into the politics today. It's you must account for every little last drop of money that's been spent, whereas actually you shouldn't bother adding it up. You should say, well, we can afford that 10 or 20% of people waste the money, because the 10 or 20% that really come up with the discoveries, because they're unconstrained, more than outweigh those negative sides. But politicians don't like that approach.
Again, on a personal front, before we start talking about public reaction to your discovery, is there a sense that you peaked early in your career? Have you been able to maintain that kind of level of significance in your work?
There's been different discoveries. So whether it's discovering comets or discovering species new to the UK or whatever, or even unusual species in the Antarctic, I have kept finding things that other people perhaps haven't noticed.
Seven comets.
But it would be nice to find something hidden in our ozone data or climate data that nobody else has noticed. And there is possibly one thing in the ozone data.
Are you working on something, are you?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes.
Secret?
I've told lots of people about it.
Tell me.
On the grounds that I can see a pattern in the data, and I need a theoretician to try and explain it.
What have you seen, John?
So it's a linkage between how the ozone is changing in the atmosphere compared to how the temperature is changing. And historically, it's been a sort of one-to-one linkage between ozone and temperature in the ozone layer, and you can see that pattern quite clearly. But over the last decade or two decades, in the high summer, there looks to have been a change, and that may be telling us there's actually been a change in the atmospheric circulation that we need to explain. So I'm trying to get the theoreticians to come up with an explanation. And that's just by me looking at the data and think, well, it's a different pattern. Whether it's a significant discovery is another matter, but there's something a little bit odd going on.
So again, putting my tabloid journalist hat on, is this as big a discovery as the one in 1984?
I doubt it, because we pretty much understand what happened in 1984. Could it be a sort of switch in circulation? I think we'd have spotted it in other ways if it was a real switch in the circulation of the stratosphere or something like that. But you never know.
But the principle, sorry.
The principle is that people should be aware that something's happening. And so if somebody else takes the credit now, I don't care because I've had my career and I've retired from Bass and I have a decent pension and I still have an office, which is really quite nice at Bass.
But it was a fulfilling career. You weren't like a Hollywood starlet to glow brightly in their early years.
No, I think I've always had fun with the science. I've had trips down to the Antarctic. I've been to various places for meetings and the like. So in many ways it's been as much a hobby as a paid job. Mm. And I think that's true for many people in Bass. Okay. It's very much a hobby and
between
pastime.
And
well, for many people it's not between 9 and 5. It goes on till late at night and weekends as well. So that in part is why it's much broader. So I still look at emails at the weekends, and if there's a query from down south, well, you respond to it as soon as you can.
That's what the reaction on a broader scale to the discovery of the ozone hole. It was quite substantial. It took a little while to get going, as you suggested, but it was actually quite substantial. Was it beyond your expectations?
Yes, I think so.
Tell me more about that.
I think I'd always thought of it as this is a small, peculiar problem for Antarctica, rather than being a global issue that will lead to international treaties and ultimately lead to a solution. It's quite clear in the latest ozone data from Antarctica that the ozone layer is beginning to recover. That's now, I'm confident it's clear. It's still too soon to say we've had the worst ever ozone hole, because you could get a combination of meteorological circumstances and geophysical circumstances that could lead to the worst ever ozone hole. But that a recovery is slowly underway is undoubted. So that's really amazing that things can be perfectly okay 60-odd years ago. You can make a discovery that things are changing. It can lead to a political process and a manufacturing process and then see the results that things are beginning to recover. It will still be another 60-odd years before we're back to where we were 60 years ago, but we're getting there. So it shows that with the knowledge and the will, you can make changes. So with the lack of knowledge, you can make dramatic changes to the atmosphere that you didn't see, but with the knowledge, you can then change the future in a positive way. And I think that's one of the key results of our paper, that the world's scientists and governments have made that commitment to change the future.
So that really ought to make you feel less gloomy and doomy about the future of mankind.
It does in this one particular case. That
it's an example that change can happen.
It's that change can happen, but it happened, I think, for almost non-scientific reasons. And that is, somebody very cleverly called it an ozone hole. And holes are bad. You need to fill in holes. So immediately, this is a problem, not something that looks quite nice. Secondly, the ozone hole allows in more ultraviolet light, which leads to skin cancers. Skin cancers are bad. We've got to do something about that. And then finally, there were alternative chemicals that could be used. So there was no major change to lifestyle. People just continued on as they had before. So all of those elements together, this is a quite straightforward thing to do something about.
So humanity got lucky?
We were lucky with this one, because if we hadn't tackled the problem, then the scientific evidence is that global warming would be much worse today than it actually is. The rate at which CFCs were accumulating in the atmosphere would have led to a substantial temperature rise today and probably depleted ozone over most of the planet rather than just over Antarctica and occasionally the Arctic. So we have changed things enormously for the better. But equally, the ozone hole was a total surprise. And the worry is that while we think we understand the atmosphere better today than we did then, are there other surprises in store for us? And there is evidence from the past that the climate can suddenly switch in a fairly short space of time. It hasn't done that for many thousands of years. What happens if the switch occurs in the next decade? We'll be stuck.
Do you know who actually did coin the phrase ozone hole? Is it Joe?
No, I don't think anybody has quite come to a definitive answer on that. I don't believe it was us. It might have been the satellite people, or it might even have been the media, just saying a hole in the ozone layer over Antarctica, and that's the one that stuck. But whoever or wherever, it was an amazing choice.
You touched on climate change. Let's just explore your views for a few minutes on climate change. Where are we now on climate change? Are we anywhere better than we were 10 years ago?
It's steadily becoming clearer that the evidence is that we are responsible for what we're seeing. There's a lot of fine detail that is not at all clear. Regional responses are much more complicated than we thought. And indeed, over Antarctica, it was widely held that the warming of the Antarctic Peninsula was a response to increased greenhouse gases. And now we're thinking, well, some of that might have been due to increased greenhouse gases. Some of it might well be due to the ozone hole itself forming and changing the wind circulation around Antarctica. And some of it might just be natural climatic variation, that actually the climate of the peninsula is highly variable anyway, and we might have just got a number of things all working together, and that might reverse in the future. So both for the BASS science and the global science, there's a greater understanding of the complexity of the system, but equally there's much better knowledge of the attribution, and the modelling is such that climate change is happening and we are behind it. What I think the public finds hard and some of the sceptics find hard is there is this expectation that it should be linear across the whole planet, and at the moment the sceptics are focusing on this so-called pause in the global warming, which the latest evidence suggests might not actually be a pause at all because we hadn't included a lot of Arctic data. But nobody ever said that it would be smooth or linear, and that's probably a failure in communication. It was quite clear on all the graphs that it wasn't going to be smooth and linear, but nobody specifically spelled it out. And my view is that, yeah, the climate may have stayed the same for a decade, but so what? When we look at climatic normals, the period for a normal is 30 years. Now, if that standstill keeps going for 30 years, well, that might be a bit more significant, but 10 years is a blink. So we need to look at the long term. And the other thing is understanding the regional patterns. And by curious chance, a good part of the eastern US didn't actually warm much in the last 50 years, whereas Western Europe did. And generally speaking, Western Europe has been more vociferous about climate change than the US has been. And that's just a consequence of what you can see in your garden. If you can see that your lawns need cutting for later in the year and you need to start cutting them earlier, you can see that the climate has changed. If nothing has much changed since you were a child, then what's all the fuss about? So having a global perspective is quite important in the debate, and I think a lot of people don't have that. They have their little narrow perspective.
Is that why George Bush Jr. was so sceptical that the Washington White House lawn was unaffected?
Yeah, I think so. It's what goes on in your backyard that makes the difference. And here in the UK, it's, I would say, blindingly obvious. We've still got leaves on the trees. We're nearly into December, so in the courtyard here, the birch there has still got all its leaves. A lot of them are still green. You wouldn't have had that when I was an undergraduate here in Cambridge. The trees came off in October, and I can remember wading through huge drifts of leaves on the way to college rooms and the like. Well, it's now a steady trickle, and they don't all leave until December.
So if you were a young, thrusting meteorological scientist today, what would you be getting into? What would you be doing about this global climate change problem?
I think the exciting thing to be doing would be to look at the extremes, and that's the extremes of the models. Largely, they're thrown out as being unrepresentative.
But the whole prove that was a wrong way to think.
Yes,
thinking,
and that might be where we ought to focus. Some of the models say an 8-degree warming in 100 years' time. That's really extreme, but could that be possible? And if some younger scientists could show, well, actually, although we've been throwing out all these extreme models because they don't represent the past climate terribly well, actually, they're a really good representation of the future climate. So I think that's probably the area that I'd suggest looking at. Look at the things that people don't think of as mainstream. There might be something in it. And similarly with the data that we're accumulating, don't just focus on the mean temperature or the maxima or the minima. Look at some other seldom looked at parameter and see maybe there's something hidden there.
Let's look at your time south. You've been 19 times. What have you been doing in all that time?
Amazingly, I think each trip has been different, and I've really enjoyed going down. So it's either been different places, doing different things, different teams of people. So I've spent time at Halley, Rothera, Faraday, Grytviken, Bird Island, very brief period of time at Cygni, but mostly just day trips, as it were, to there. So I've had experience of all the Bass stations, and that's a privilege not accorded to many in Bass, that yes, the VIPs will pass through all of them, but they're mostly just there for a few days. All of those stations, I've been there for weeks, and that gives me a really good feel for how the stations operate. And also, on most of the trips, I've not been narrowly focused on just the science that I need to do down there. And again, in recent years, most people, they've got to just go in, do their science, and then go out again. So I've had time to look at what other people are doing, help with the daily duties and so on. And I think the people on the stations have really appreciated that as well. And also, it's being able to do that has made the stays much more enjoyable. So I think one of the really memorable ones, well, they've all been memorable in
pick
one
an
way,
example.
Way or another. But going to Bird Island, I'd been through Bird Island lots of times on the way to Halley, and I'd always thought of it as a horrid place. There's all those fur seals on the beach. It's always drizzling. Who on earth would want to go down there? But I had the opportunity to go to install an automatic weather station on the island. And the first day I was there, it was a brilliant day. There was not a cloud in the sky. We went and had a picnic up in the hills behind the station. And it was lovely. And I got used to the fur seals fairly quickly. Surprisingly, we were all scientists. There was nothing in the way of technical staff there. We all got on really well. We helped each other out, did things, made a really nice team. And it was a fantastic stay. So Bird Island is a well-kept secret. And similarly, my last trip to south to Halle, I was rather dreading the stay because I've been told, oh, you'll be sleeping in a container and it's going to be incredibly busy. But I ended up being on the old Halle 5 station, where there were only sort of 20 of us at peak time, and commuted to the new station as and when I needed to. And it turned out to be a really nice stay there. And again, towards the end, I had time to help other people out. So we started dismantling lots of things from the old station. And the guys were left saying, oh, this is the chap that discovered the Arizona. And he's got a screwdriver in his hand, he's taking bits off the wall. That was really good.
Do you enjoy that?
So, yes, yeah. I mean, it's part of understanding the science, that if you know how people normally live on the station, you need to be part of that as well to get that more distant perspective.
You're one of the few FIDs who's been to Halle 3, 4, 5 and 6.
Yeah.
If not the only one. Certainly one of the few.
I think Mike Pinnock must have been to Halle, to all of them as well.
And you were involved in the design and the delivery of the current Halle 6.
Yes, and Halle 5.
Okay.
Probably more so of Halle 5 for the Simpson platform than Halle 6.
What criteria were you insisting upon for either or both?
Well, for Halle 5, we wanted the scope to be able to do our measurements on the sun. So you had to have somewhere where the Dobson could view overhead. And at that time, we had the Angstrom pyrometer, which needed to be able to view the sun directly. So the only window that opened on the entire Halle 5 station were the windows in the Simpson, where we had opening windows so we could make these observations. At Halle 6, one of the key things, again, was to have access for the Dobson through the roof so you can see the sun directly. And for meteorology, you needed a round vision of the station. So we've got the science module with its upper deck, where there's spectacular views all the way around, and where the Dobson can, with its big periscope, stick straight up out of the roof. So we've actually got, I think, the best platform for doing our meteorological measurements at Halley 6 that we've ever had. The only slightly downside is getting to the science modules, where if it's a bit too windy, they can't actually travel across.
Did you have to fight for that? Were there those who were saying, you must be joking?
Yes, there was a strong view that we can't afford this upper deck. We've got to downscale and perhaps go out on the surface. But I was quite insistent that in order to do the science that is almost one of the primary functions of Halle, we need that facility, both to support the science and to support the aircraft operations. Because, again, it's the meteorologists that do the weather observations for the pilots. And if you can't see all the way around, you might miss that blank of fog that's going to come in and block off the runway.
So it doubles as an air traffic control?
It doesn't double as air traffic control. That's in the command module at Halle 6. But it's the observation deck which feeds the weather observations in for the aircraft.
We haven't got the money is always a very powerful argument. How did you overcome it?
I think just by digging in my heels, and I suppose because I was such an important person, they listened.
Well, my next question was, if the man who discovers the ozone hole digs his heels in, is that an advantage?
And I think for this case it was. And also because in part it was within the architect's vision of what they wanted. So
it wasn't an extra then, it was
something that was to an extent key to the development.
Were you there for the handover?
Yep, I helped raise the flag for the first time at the new station, and I took down the flag at the old station as well, which was really nice. The guys at the old station said, "You're doing it," and somebody at the new station said that you're doing it. Which again showed what sort of esteem that they hold me in. But I think if I hadn't mucked in with doing lots of the other stuff, I wouldn't have been. So because I get my hands dirty and discover the ozone hole, we'll let you do this. And that was, I think, really one of the nicest things that they could have done. And at Halley 6, they wanted a picture of me, and so here you are. And then as a complete surprise, one lunchtime, they'll bang on the table and make this presentation of a picture and said, "This is the first picture that's going to be hung on the new station, and we're putting it in the ozone module, and we've got permission to put it up on the wall." And I think, wow. and that was a really nice compliment.
Is there anything else about Halley 6 which is really going to further the cause of science? I asked that question to Steve Caldwell, and he just said, well, it isn't going to fall in the sea very soon. But is there something else about, are there other things about Halley 6 which really advance the science that you are keen to propagate?
One of the key things is it's got all the scientists together. So at Halley 5, there was a Simpson platform and the Pigott platform, and there were two separate groups almost. Mm. Now it's one team of scientists, which makes a difference. In theory, it's easier to put new stuff in. Whether that actually works in practice because of some design features is another matter. But we have got an outstanding platform, I hope, for the future for doing new science. So that was a key part of the vision, was making it sufficiently flexible that we can do things that we're not doing today and we've got no idea what they're going to be, but we can put them in. That philosophy worked very well at Halley 5 because Brian and I, with paper and pencil, did a layout of what we wanted, and that worked fine for 20 years. And I think that was quite amazing, that the Simpson platform, which we designed, was actually the most successful of all the Halley 5 buildings. It wasn't too big, it wasn't too small, met our requirements perfectly. We could do some modifications internally, and we could probably have kept using it for another 20 years if all was said and done, if we'd had to. So I think Halley 6 should be good. The one slight downside is if we have to move it, because if we have to move it, we have to stop all the science because there'll be no power. And that is really bad for long-term monitoring. So we're going to have to come up with a strategy that lets us keep at least part of the science going where it is, and starts up the science at the new location at the same time. So that will require a bit of planning.
One of the questions I've got to ask you, it's on my list of absolute musts, is to ask you to give us a soundbite or an explanation, if you like, as to why long-term observations of surface and upper atmosphere meteorology and ozone is so important. And this is the standard schoolboy question.
The long-term monitoring is key because without it, you don't know if there's been changes. And that was really exemplified by the ozone hole, where we had continuous data, the Japanese didn't. The Japanese couldn't say that something systematic was happening, we could. And that basis occurs time and time again in environmental monitoring. A lot of the time you have snapshots, and you can say, well, that's changed, but is that a one-off? If you don't know because you haven't got that sequence, you can't make any deductions. It might just be that the weather that year had been unusual. So you need the context, and that's what our long-term monitoring gives. Gives us the context. You can say straight away, right, this is an unusual circumstance, and that's why this year is different. Or actually, everything else is exactly the same, but that data is totally different. So it's needed not only for the physical monitoring of the atmosphere, but for the biological studies. It was something actually in a talk I went to on Wednesday. Somebody had been looking at the number of swifts in Fulbourne, and they were saying, "Oh, it's because it's going down, and oh, this last year it's gone up again." And I didn't sort of queried at the time, but after the talk, I went up to the chap and said, well, look, I can see your data points, and that one's sort of 120, and that's 80, and that's 70, and that's 60, and then it's back up to 80. Now, why wasn't it 82 or something like that? And clearly, the data had been rounded to the nearest 10. So that immediately says, well, there's probably an error bar of certainly plus or minus 5 and probably plus or minus 10. So those last 3 years, there's no actual real difference between them. And then have you compared this with either someone else that's been looking at Swift numbers or the weather? Because you don't know whether that trend is linked to what you're doing in Fulbourne or whether it's linked to external forces. You say, ooh, no, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, I'll go and get the Oxford data and see if they've got the same sort of pattern. And if you haven't got that reference, you can't answer those questions. So you might draw totally the wrong conclusion about the effect you've seen if you don't have that background. So that's why it's important. And equally why we must keep doing it in the future, because we won't know how effective we've been in our controls. So with the ozone hole, if we'd stopped immediately after we'd discovered the paper, well, we found the discovery now, don't need to do anything. I couldn't say today, well, actually, the Halley data shows a very slow recovery over the last 20 years. But it's taken 20 years to find that actually there is a slow recovery over 20 years.
Are you, you're early 60s now, are you likely to go south again?
I hope so. It'd be nice to have a 20th visit down. Whether I'll go with Bass or sign up to a tour ship and go down as a guest lecturer, I'm not sure.
What's making you want to go? What's the attraction?
Antarctica is wonderful.
Elaborate, please.
It's a combination of the people, the scenery, the atmosphere. And, yeah, I'm addicted to it, I suppose.
Have you ever had any awkward moments, close calls, close shaves?
Yes.
Ones you can talk about?
Probably, I'm not sure. There was certainly one trip from Faraday where we were going boating to stay at Petermann Island, and we sort of had this thing planned for ages. And then the day with nice blue skies, right, calm conditions, right, off we go. So got to Petermann, and then one of the things we'd planned to do there was to go outside our boating limits and do something we weren't supposed to do, which was sail one of the little seagull fiberglass boats with the seagull engines up the Lemaire Channel, round the island and then back. And as a meteorologist, I should have been looking up at the clouds, but wasn't. And off we went, and it was fine going up the Lemaire and really spectacular. And I think, I'm not sure how many other people have been up the Lemaire, a little fiberglass boat, but we did it. But coming around the other end, we were now exposed to the wind and the waves, and they were getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But we'd arranged a rendezvous with a French yacht in a little bit of a harbour, and we made it through to them. But they could see we were quite wet and cold, so rather than going on back to Petermann, they said, well, come on board, have a nice warm meal, get yourselves dried up. So, OK, this sounds a good idea. So we tied up the boats on the back of the yacht. But the wind kept getting up further and further and further, which I should have realised because I could have seen the cirrus first of all coming in, and then the cirrus stratus, a nice halo, and I think the weather charts, if I'd bothered looking at them in the long range, would have shown that it was this big system. So the winds kept getting up, and the skipper of the yacht decided, right, we're in danger of getting icebound here, so we're going to go out in the bay. And the wind kept getting up, and every now and again the yacht would go right the way over. We've had it. But it was a skilled skipper, and got us out. One of the boats was completely awash by the end of the gale. We lost the medical box. Both the diesels were flooded. But we bailed everything out, and went back to Peterman, got ashore, tidied things up a bit, and told the base commander that there'd been a very high tide and it had washed away the box. But that was a fairly close call, that we might not have survived that particular one.
I asked that question because you became a very active union rep on the Health and Safety Committee at Bass. Yep. So, and most FIDs have got one, or if not more than one, near miss. So I'm wondering whether the near misses informed your involvement in that organisation.
Yes, but not in the way you might expect, actually.
Oh, God.
One problem I had was that Bass would always try and wrap people up in cotton wool and stop them doing things. But actually, what you need to do is inform people what the risks are and let them experience some of those risks. And that's quite important, that actually wrapping people in cotton wool makes life more dangerous because you can't see what the risks actually are. And so in the Antarctic, yes, you do need boundaries, but you also need people who are capable of taking and evaluating risks. So you don't want to put yourself in danger, but you do need to be able to see, yeah, I can do that. The regs may say you can't, but actually, because this and this, it's perfectly safe. And you need to let people use their skill and experience rather than constraining them. And that's the approach that I always try to take here. But equally, sometimes you get very minor risks, but everybody takes part in them. And there you do need to put in controls, even though the odds of any one person being hurt are very, very small. But if everybody in the building takes part in it, you're sooner or later going to have a problem. And one example was the front doors into the reception.
Here?
Here.
At Bass HQ.
Everybody has to come in and out of the building. And the old doors were on an automatic swing, and there was a very small gap between the two. And it was quite dodgy to go through if you were by yourself. But because of this automatic closure, every now and again it would sort of give you a bit of a knock. And I said, look, this isn't safe. You've got to do something about it. And nothing happened. Then a child coming in was hit by the door. I think they eventually took it to hospital. And I said, right, here's a union improvement notice. You must do something about it now. We've had enough messing around and saying we'll do something at some point. And now it was a small risk, but because everybody was exposed to it, the chance of a problem was much higher than the Bass management had really thought about. So there's the two sides of the argument. Yes, you need people to be able to take risks, but you need to be able to control them so that you're aware of what the risks are. So that's what I try to do as a union rep.
That's counter-conventional thinking, though, isn't it? I mean, most health and safety officers, traditionally, or perhaps...
Yep.
Legend has it that they try and stop things from happening.
Yes.
Whereas you're actually trying to facilitate things happening.
I would much rather facilitate and educate so that people know what it is that they're doing, because then you're much more careful. So another example, with my bell ringing hat on, we have a vertical ladder to get up to the bells. And if health and safety, you need hoops around it, that will make it much safer. But when you want to try and take something up the ladder, the hoops actually make it more dangerous because you've got lots of things to catch on. So knowing how to climb the ladder safely is the key thing. And I've taken children up there and, right, you have 3 points and you always do that and you go up safely. Oh, this is actually, yes, it's risky, but I'm in control. I'm doing it safely. There's not a problem. If something goes drastically wrong, then there's a problem. But they're being taught how to do the thing safely, and that's fine. So health and safety say, oh, no, we can't have that. But I'm saying, yes, you can have it. But A, you're aware of what's can go wrong, and B, this is how you climb safely.
So were there lots of contentious discussions in the health and safety body at Bass?
Not many, really. It was remarkably consensual. And again, that's how it ought to be. Union side and management should be working together to help the process, because it's in both parties' interests. You don't want accidents, both because for management there's a huge cost involved, and for union side there's a personal cost involved. So if you can work together, work together.
But how did you how successful were you in imposing health and safety regulations on a couple of guys in a tent in the middle of the Antarctic?
I never actually had to do that. what I always tried to do was, if it was being discussed here in Cambridge, then I would try and say, well, look, you need to let them go out in the tent, but you need to train them in how to put the tent up. And Bass has always actually been pretty good at training people.
These days.
There were issues, certainly, with the cooking stoves, and that was sort of one of the big issues, is carbon monoxide. But largely, I think most of the carbon monoxide problems were self-inflicted because people didn't do exactly as they were supposed to do. They quite often took a few shortcuts. But you couldn't say you weren't briefed about the dangers of carbon monoxide, because all the training tells you carbon monoxide's an issue.
On that particular point, there are numerous FID stories which I've collected over the years where the ventilation aspect of the tent got clogged up with snow and nobody realised.
Yeah, and that can happen. And I remember myself at Petermann Island at the Argentinian refuge where we stayed. This had the triple-decker bunk and a coal fire. And it was really nice having this coal fire blazing in its little stove. But I think we always woke up with headaches the next morning. And almost certainly that was carbon monoxide that was doing it. So at that time we didn't probably realise the dangers. But that was in the 1980s. And I think it wasn't really until the 1990s that we started realising that actually carbon monoxide is a bigger problem than we thought it was.
I was a little bit surprised to realise there was an active union at Bass.
It can be a little bit hidden, but yes, there's always been the two main unions in Bass, Prospect and PCS. Prospect, by and large, tries to do things consensually and work with management. PCS has traditionally been a much more vociferous union and more prone to go out on strike. But I've been on a union called Strike here in Bass.
About what?
I think it was pay and conditions. It was many, many years ago. And then I actually, following that, resigned from the union because I thought, well, no, I don't want to do this anymore. And then some years later, I think it was David Peel asked me, would you like to be the union rep for health and safety? We think it'd be a good choice. And I said, well, I'm not actually a union member. Oh, well, you can join again. So, okay, right, I'll become the union rep and rejoin the union.
But there's a bit of a dichotomy between, you were saying earlier, and I can understand that completely, that many people working in this building and in the Antarctic regard it as a hobby for which you get paid, something they really, really want to do. And the kind of traditional view of a union, which is more designed to protect people who are doing jobs they don't really want to do.
Yes, I mean, in Bass, it was not... I think everybody wanted to do things. There were very few things that we didn't want to do, so that's why it was quite consensual. And perhaps why not that many people are union members. I think it's about 100 or so of the total staff that are...
Right.
A union member. So it's a reasonable number. But on health and safety, we represent everybody, not just the union members. And that, I think, was one of the big differences. As a union health and safety rep, it's everybody that was involved. And I always stressed that even whether you're not a union member. If you've got any issues on health and safety, come to me, I'll get them sorted out.
Has there been a big incident in your time on that committee that you've had to consider?
We've had a number of things where there's been a sort of board of inquiry. One was a carbon monoxide incident in the Arctic, which led to the realisation that, A, not all countries have the same health and safety practices as others, and B, that we're slightly two-faced about how we do health and safety. In the Antarctic, it's very strict and quite well regimented, but you go to the Arctic and it was rather less controlled. If you're on Svalbard, that was fine, but you could do field work elsewhere, and some of the processes weren't quite as good as they should have been.
Were you involved in the aftermath of the death of Kirsty Brown 10 years ago?
Yes, I was. But that particular incident was another of these unlikely combinations of circumstances. Nobody had ever been attacked in the water by a leopard seal before, and that was certainly a result of the inquiry, that this was a very unusual event. And it resulted in changes in operation being put into place that certainly so far has been successful in controlling the risk. And that was quite a shock, her death, because I knew her from when I was in at Rotherham the year before. So, yes, we've had deaths over the years. That perhaps was one of the few where it was actually the person doing the job rather than at least part recreational linked. So a lot of the other tragedies, it's people going out on their 10-day trip or whatever.
A jolly.
Or taking pictures of a plane as it goes overhead and came a little bit too low for safe passage. Or you're trying to get back to the station for Saturday night and things like that, and you're travelling in conditions that aren't quite what you're supposed to be travelling in. Whereas Kirsty, it was, we thought we'd done everything. And actually, no, we'd forgotten that one thing.
Which was
the leopard seal. That actually, if a leopard seal's around, best practice is not to be in the water, just in case.